We've heard from you, Scott. Now, you tell us a little about yourself.
The details of my life are quite inconsequential.
Oh, no, please, please. Let's hear about your childhood.
Yeah, okay. Come on, come on, come on, please.
Very well. Where do I begin? My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner from Belgium with low-grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. My mother was a 15-year-old French prostitute named Chloe with webbed feet. My father would womanize, he would drink, he would make outrageous claims like he invented the question mark. Sometimes he would accuse chestnuts of being lazy, the sort of general malaise that only the genius possess and the insane lament. My childhood was typical. Summers in Rangoon, luge lessons. In the spring, we'd make meat helmets. When I was insolent, I was placed in a burlap bag and beaten with reeds. Pretty standard, really. At the age of 12, I received my first scribe. At the age of 14, a Zoroastrian named Vilma ritualistically shaved my testicles. At the age of 18, I went off to evil medical school. At the age of 25, I took up tap dancing. I wanted to be a quadruple threat. An actor, a dancer.
You know, we have to stop.
Pre-recorded live from Pennsylvania and Nebraska, U.S. of A. It's the Bob and Elvis Show.
Right on!
With Bob Seska and Elvis Dingledean.
Is this Tagus 3?
I doubt there are many oak trees on Tagus. No, I think this is supposed to be Earth. Somewhere around about the 12th century. And this is England, or to be more precise, Sherwood Forest, at least Kew's recreation of it.
That will explain these costumes.
Quite right, number one. Or should I say, John Little.
Well, if he's Little John, that makes you...
I know. Robin Hood.
Sir, I protest. I am not a merry man.
The following podcast contains harsh language, nudity, graphic violence, adult situations, and a healthy obsession with empirical reality. The Bob and Elvis Show.
See, every time you talk about when you grew up in Germany with your lederhosen and your ritualistic testicle shaving, I always think of that clip.
I don't remember that part exactly, the testicle shaving.
Maybe I just threw that in there.
Yeah.
I'm merging Dr. Evil's childhood with yours.
Poor Worf. Worf really only existed to be made fun of and humiliated.
Yeah, this was the whole idea of his characters. They would just throw him in incongruously embarrassing scenarios.
Yeah, so they could laugh at him. This is very racist. I think it's because he was a Klingon, you know? They just had to make fun of him and treat him like shit and make him jump off boats and stuff.
Well, so the original show, the original series, it was always a big ordeal to cover up Spock's Vulcan-ness. Like, they always had to cover up his ears and his eyebrows and... And the same thing was happening with Worf. But they made no bones about sticking Data back in, you know, San Francisco in, you know, 1889 or whatever it was.
Yeah, they always seem to forget that Data was an albino plastic person.
Yeah. It's just
let's take him to Earth prior to first contact where they've never seen an android. But let's dress him in period clothing because we're going to fool everybody.
Yeah.
Cuz he's a man made out of plastic. You can shoot him with a machine gun. In that same episode, well, that you've seen it.
Yeah, the double episode with
with
Mark Twain in there.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it actually
had some great the TV show had some great moments, but there was just not a good Next Gen movie ever.
No. But you know, my favorite thing about that double episode, and this is really delving into the depths of the basement of the science building.
Yeah,
it's got Picard's most outraged. But incongruously outraged line ever in the history of that show.
What was that?
They're looking at Data's severed head, the head that they found in the cave.
Yeah.
And they're standing there in engineering for some reason. And they've got Data's head prop there, and they've got it opened up, and they're looking at it, and Geordi's explaining that the processor is a Type R processor.
Mm.
And out of nowhere, Picard just goes... Type R. As it was like incomprehensible that it's got a Type R processor. Anyway,
like he knows, Type like R. He knows the different kind of processors in an animatronic brain.
Type R, you say?
Bullshit.
Bullshit. That's I call bullshit. That's Type S.
Oh God.
Number one. I was watching the extras episode with Patrick Stewart this morning, actually, where Ricky Gervais is sitting there. Ricky Gervais's character is sitting there talking to him about acting and everything. Patrick Stewart's written his own script, and he plays a guy like Dr. X, Dr. Xavier, who can make things happen with his mind, and he's always making girls' clothes fall off. Talk about incongruous. That's the best part of that show is the way the writers got, the way Gervais and Steve Merchant got all their actors to do, all their guest actors to do things completely antithetical to their normal, you know, characters.
Yeah, where Patrick Stewart's like this lady killer.
Yeah, well, just this perv.
Yeah, just a total perv.
I
just
make their clothes fall off, and I've seen everything. It's just like, yeah, that's what Patrick Stewart's like. That's great.
Oh,
that's
hey, great. So it's the Bubble Genius Bob and Elvis show, sponsored exclusively by Bubble Genius, pure products, pure genius. Bubble Genius at www.bubblegenius.com. Last week was a pretty popular show.
Was it?
It was a pretty popular show. Lots of response to last week's show. In fact, I was getting, which rarely happens, I was getting rare email responses to the show.
Yeah, I got a few myself. I'm starting to get them now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Emails.
And a lot of it had to do with the second third of the show. It was basically 3 half-hours of the show.
Yeah, 3 half-hours.
And the second half-hour of the show, where you and I were fighting about NPR, that got the most response. I wasn't fighting,
having a discussion. I mean,
that's right.
We can't always just kiss each other's asses.
Well, I think that's where a lot of people lose sight of the fact that you can have a heated debate about a political topic, or any topic for that matter, and not have it be, a fight.
Yeah, you a dick or anything.
No, it was over. Well, you did say I was from another planet.
Well, yeah, I asked what planet you were from.
Said, what planet are you from, sir? Type R.
Type R?
But it was a good debate, and I got a bunch of emails saying that we should have more of those where we actually disagree on things.
Well, we can't manufacture dissent.
No,
I mean, we agree on mostly, although I think we probably disagree pretty strongly on Libya, so we should probably get into that.
Yeah, well, we do. That would be shocking. I can't believe that we would.
Yeah,
well, we do disagree on Libya, do we?
I don't know. According to the blog, I mean, I haven't seen much outrage and much huffy, puffy, red-cheeked liberal outrage from you on it, so I would imagine we do.
No, no, no. Well, I was going to say, if we were actually manufactured disagreement for the show, it would turn out to be the show that I did with Lee Stranahan.
I was going to say, it was agree to disagree or whatever.
Yeah, it was agree to disagree, where he would just deliberately take the opposite position that I would have.
It would just be like Python's argument clinic. It wouldn't be interesting. I mean, we had a legitimate debate, and then we tried to follow it up with some postings on the... I'm not a fan of this new 24-hour shutdown thing on the comments.
Oh, yeah. Well,
because some of these discussions have their own natural shelf life and could go on and on for days and days. I think that's one of the interesting things about blogging is how various conversations can continue in the comments.
Well, see here, the comments section of the blog is an ongoing pain in the ass. It really is. I've actually contemplated just eliminating the comments entirely. That's what Sullivan didn't have comments on his thing for years.
Well, he still doesn't.
He still doesn't. That's right. I think he was debating whether or not to open them up for comments, but still, just decided not to. And for good damn reason.
Yeah.
Because, of course, when I have registration set up where you have to register, it's a pain in the ass, and no one likes it. Everyone hates it. There's constant sign-in problems. Ah, TypePad won't remember my name, or TypePad won't let me sign in. So that's a crisis. So I take registration off. Then anyone can post. Anyone who wants to post can post. Well, then there are issues there. Then you get all the trolls, which is fine by me. I mean, I don't mind. I actually like the trolls as long as you don't feed them.
Yeah.
So
but that's impossible. No matter how much you tell the audience, tell the normal Seskites or whatever, not to feed trolls, they will.
They still do.
I'm one of the worst offenders. I fucking hate trolls.
Yeah. But that's all they want. They feed off of that. They want you to do. I mean, they stoke people's, you know.
They're there.
Yeah, yeah. As you want to, you just fight them.
Well, how about this? How about this as an option? You've seen these UBEE, these third-party plug-in chat boards, like bulletin board style things?
Yeah.
Why not set one of those up that's connected to but separate from the actual blog, the content stream, so that you can have open discussions about topics where and it's sort of a self-moderating thing, right?
I mean,
that would be an option. And close commentary down and maybe up the frequency of content.
I don't know. I could start a discussion board. I think what I'm going to do is just switch the whole thing over to WordPress, where the comment area is a lot heartier.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely is. Because you're still on movable type now, right?
Yeah, which everyone seems to hate. And
well, it's old and defunct by now. I mean, it used to be open source, and now WordPress is definitely, at least in the comment, that's how I used to run ClusterDouche, was on WordPress, and it did have really lots of plugins, lots of third-party stuff for monitoring and policing that stuff. So, yeah.
Well, the problem is,
big effort.
The problem is switching over to WordPress requires making sure that all of the posts transfer over, and then
just a database thing. That's easy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, then you also want some of the comments to move over, because there are a lot of posts that, you know, you go back to 2008 especially, where there were a lot of open threads and there were a lot of live bloggings of the debates and of the primaries, where the comments were actually very much, I mean, even more important than the posts in a lot of ways, because it was just an ongoing commentary of what was happening.
Yeah.
And especially like election night. I mean, it's like those things. Maybe I'll just the really important ones, I'll just move all the comments into the post themselves. And then just
I think you can find some database translators that'll go from movable type to WordPress in one go, where it'll replicate everything, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's all very scary.
Yeah.
It's all
I know. I remember doing that myself. It actually was a lot easier than it looked. So
I mean, it was literally like 2 weeks of an ordeal just upgrading from movable type version 2 to 3.3 or whatever I'm using.
Oh, really? See, WordPress is like one click upgrade, boom.
Yeah.
It does everything in turn. It just zoop. Like I was running it all from Network Solutions, I think, and it just had a button on your dashboard. It's like upgrade to the next version, and it was done in 3 seconds. Fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
Super easy.
Well, so there's Libya happening now, and you seem to think that we're going to disagree on Libya.
Well, I don't know. I really don't know your. I mean, I've seen some tweets, but I don't know. So how are you feeling about it?
Well, I mean, initially I was quite ambivalent about it, and the my issue stemmed more from fiscal hypocrisy than any sort of disagreement about the policy itself. You know, I was like, I mean, how can we possibly nickel and dime, you know, all of these social programs, cutting the shit out of them in a lot of cases, and then say, well, we can go into a no-fly zone enforcement situation without even having a discussion, without even bringing up the idea of what it's going to cost.
Yeah, but I think a lot of that cost is baked into the military already. I mean, I always see it as just a tomahawk that's not going to hit somebody in Afghanistan. I mean, the tomahawk's already been paid for and racked and ready to go. It just needs a target. So I'm not so worried about the price of it. I mean, nothing gets paid for anyway, so fuck it. I mean, it's if this was a Republican, you know, presidency and war, then yeah, I mean, fiscal hypocrisy galore. But my thing is just, what the fuck? What the fuck are we doing? It's now that it's being handed over to NATO, I'm a little less pissed off. I mean, I think NATO, what the fuck is NATO for anymore? I mean, I grew up around NATO. I mean, I frequent trips to Brussels for, you know, NATO high, not me personally. I didn't get to meet anybody, but I mean, my dad and NATO was the big thing. I mean, when I was 6, I knew what NATO stood for. NATO was it, man. It was the thing. What does it do now? Now it needs to retask itself to protecting, you know, being a big North Atlantic or, you know, Middle Eastern treaty organization, MEATO. it needs to do fucking something. And this is a good idea. I mean, hand it over to NATO before the UN. My problem is the one world order guys, the Glenn Becks and the idiots like that, think the UN is going to take over the world. And doing this without I mean, there's the Glenn Greenwalds of the world that think it's all, you know, unconstitutional and he needs to get impeached for it and blah, blah, blah. My only problem is the UN is the face of the one world government, and this just feeds into this internal paranoia here and overseas and in Libya and elsewhere. One little fuck up in this no-fly zone, which is really a, you know, a bombing thing, one little civilian fuck up and the pendulum swings back to us and we're evil imperialist baby killers again. And I just don't want that to hang around this president. This president inherited two piece of shit wars. I don't want this is his first, you know, one that he owns entirely himself. I don't want to start this neo-imperialist bullshit again.
Yeah, but it's not that kind of situation.
Well, not yet. We're not going, but it could be.
Going in there and occupying anything. I mean, well, that's just it. I mean,
Greens are waiting. They're offshore and ready to roll. So you never know. Yeah. I just don't know. I mean, it's not over yet. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm super ambivalent. I'm not terribly happy about any of it.
Yeah. Well, see, I mean, I think this is where we're kind of parting ways on this. I think, you know, there's a lot of posturing going on. Sure. Yeah. I mean, we're gonna move a lot of troops over there to tell everyone we mean business. And this, yeah. But I don't think. I mean, I would be shocked if we actually put boots on the ground in Libya. There's just no way. Unless there's already a regime set up and we're just going in there just to, you know, add some additional protection. But I don't think that's even going to happen.
No, I don't. But I think there's still potential for disaster even without boots on the ground. I mean, first of all, I mean, even from a conceptual, this sets either a really good precedent or a really bad precedent, depending on how the region reacts to it long term. This either says to the region, okay, these bullshit governments, these regimes, when they're faced with legitimate opposition, cannot shoot their own people and run them over with tanks and blow them up with planes, or America will come, you know, this coalition will come down on you and blow up your SAM sites and put a foot up your ass. That's the good. And then if that works, then that's a good precedent. The bad precedent is, you know, okay, all these douchebag regimes are going to push at the same time and see just how solid our resolve is and how much money and time and resources we have to be this sort of uprising protector shield. And I think that's dangerous. I don't know that we've got the resolve or the time and the money and the effort and the troops and the machinery to do that. It's just where's the no-fly zone above Gaza, for example? I mean, there's just untold instances of this, you know, just uncountable times where we need to be doing this. And I don't know. I think it sets a really bad precedent.
I think much like Kosovo, the reason that this was very carefully calculated as far as determining that this was a sort of situation that we could win, that we could actually prevail. And so therefore it became a higher priority over something like Gaza. Like Gaza, there's no end game in Gaza. Like if we were to set up a no-fly zone over Gaza, that would just be an endless clusterfuck. That would just never stop. And because there's never going to be peace there. As long, you know, there are so many factors that go into play there. What we've got in Libya is we're just giving a process a kick in the ass. We're just moving. We're just backing up the rebels at this point. And
but we don't even know who those rebels are, what they want. I don't even think they know, really. I mean, is this civil war? Is it sectarian? Is it, you know, push for democracy? We don't know. We don't really know in this case. It's not like it's not like Tunisia and Egypt, where we sort of knew, you know, even the government knew what they were. The rational but semi-despotic governments that weren't led by total crackpots. I mean, Gaddafi is just a total crackpot. I mean, just absolute insane person. And in those instances, we knew, you know, we didn't have to intervene, but we knew what the political and social forces were moving those rebellions. I don't think anybody knows what is driving these Libyans. And we're not seeing mass defections from Gaddafi's loyalists either, where in Egypt and these other places, they're like, you know what? I'm not shooting my own people. Fuck you. You know, put my rifle down. That's not happening. He's easily paying people to shoot his own their own people. I mean, that doesn't seem like something I want to, you know, I want to get behind. I don't know who these fuckers are, and I don't know once they kick Gaddafi in the ass, if I mean, if they don't, if we don't get him out of here, get him out of there, and he just entrenches, we're fucked.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole region's fucked. This guy has got no qualms about outsourcing terror and blowing people up, and, you know, the British and the French and the Italians are putting their imprimatur on this, and that means if he doesn't go, they're fucked. I mean, it's we're going to have to get this guy, and then we don't know what we got after that.
Well, there's a big difference, I think, though, between this and Egypt, where in Egypt it wasn't so clear because, I mean, in Egypt we had a friendly guy. I mean, we had a friendly leader in a way. We didn't want to say he was a friendly leader, but that was the subtext and all of that. I mean, that's why we didn't intervene in there. Yeah, but then, I mean, with Gaddafi, and this is a major distinction. Gaddafi's an enemy to the Western world. I mean, it's just whether it was Lockerbie or, you know, just an ongoing thorn in the sides of you know, the Allies.
He started cooperating after 9/11. I mean, we sort of turned him after 9/11 in some pretty, I mean, John McCain was just over there kissing his ass a year ago. I mean, he's now we're like, oh yeah, we remember back in the 80s when Ronnie Reagan, you know, dropped bombs on him. Well, now we're all remembering how much we hate this douche. But, you know, and just until it's just been until he started shooting his own people and acting like a crazy person that we remember that this is someone we, you know, detest enough to get into this game on. It just feels all very convenient and manufactured to me. And I'm just not, my heart's not in it at all.
Well,
I get it.
I don't know what we could possibly get our heart into as far as a military action, but I mean, as far as opposing it, I don't think there's any reason.
Libya number one, when Ronnie Reagan, I remember playing poker in my basement in Burke, had a bunch of my teenage, you know, my high school buddies over, and we were in the basement playing poker, and the news came on right at that moment that we were bombing the shit out of Libya, dropping bombs on Tripoli. And I was, you know, hardcore Republican back then, and we were all Ronnie, Ronnie, Ronnie. That was one you could get some ass behind. You got, you know, you felt it in your stomach, like, oh, that's a good, you know, that's a good war. That's a good thing to do. Drop some bombs on Tripoli. Now it's like, I kind of want to go back to the days of Afghanistan number one, like when the Russians were in Afghanistan, when the CIA when we took care of rebels by cartloading, you know, suitcases full of cash and Stinger missiles but that's a perfect example of why I'm ambivalent. Look at how that turned out. I mean, that's how we used to do things. That's how we used to fund rebels against despotic either invaders or regimes. We would fund the other side, and then the other side always comes back to bite us in the ass.
Yeah.
So that's my point. That's my problem. I don't know who the good guys are in this. I don't know what the rebels want. I don't know what kind of government they're going to set up when they get it. I don't know how badly sectarian shifts are going to happen in Libya between Sunni and Shia, if it's going to be another, you know, Iranian puppet state. I don't know any of this, and no one does. And that, to me, is not something you want to line up a coalition. I don't know why the Arab League is, you know, all for this all of a sudden when they usually tell us to mind our own fucking business. It just all seems very cagey to me.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can respect that opinion. I just don't think that that it's going to be allowed. It's going to be left to chance like that. I mean, I think a considerable amount of interference is going to be played by the UN as far as setting up a new government to replace Gaddafi once and when he leaves. And it's just a matter of time before he's out. I mean, that's
why? Why do you think that?
Because I don't think this would have ever taken place if they didn't have intelligence leading them to believe. I'm talking about France and England and especially the United States. If they didn't have intelligence leading them to believe that Gaddafi was on his way out anyway. Hmm. I mean,
I haven't seen anything about that. Yeah. So I have a feeling he's crackpot enough to. I mean, we probably said the same thing about Saddam, and it took us a fucking year and a half to find him in a well.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking about
it.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about an entirely different group here. I mean, working in it with intelligence from France, intelligence from England. I mean, you know,
that
now
helps us a lot in Iraq too.
Well, they didn't really participate. I mean. Yeah,
is there yellow cake? Do we know that Gaddafi has yellow cake? He's got yellow cake, doesn't he?
I believe that they're going to get in. The only reason they got into this so heartily is because they felt that this was, you know, this was a government on its way out, that he wasn't going to be lasting very long. And that's why our participation has been limited. That's why NATO is taking over at this point. And
that I'm happy about. I mean, that gave me cause for some small bit of relief. I mean, I don't like the UN. Obama's done this series of things over the last few days or last couple of weeks that seem to be feeding directly into the hysteria from the far wackaloon wing nut right about the ways that he's going to literally subvert democracy and kill us all in our sleep. There was something going around, and I never really saw any detail on it, but something about he was looking at executive order ways, you know, stroke of a pen ways to deal with gun control outside of congressional approval. That seemed like a god-awful idea. I mean, just god awful if you want to really mobilize the wing nuts. And now, you know, military action without congressional approval through the UN. It's just like, oh, fuck me. The worst. And, you know, being egged on by Samantha Powers and some of these, you know, the wing nut trifecta of people that they absolutely hate, love to hate and put up on the Glenn Beck whiteboards. It's just. I don't know. I would tread more carefully if I were the president.
Well, I don't understand this. This goes back to the NPR. This is the hinge of our discussion about NPR last week. I don't understand why you're suddenly so concerned about what the far right and the Republicans have to say about this president. As we've witnessed all along, they're just going to make up shit anyway. I mean, yeah. So why even bother tap dancing around them?
Well, I don't know. I just...
They're going to come up with conspiracy theories about one world government and how the president's going to turn the United States into a Sharia law-driven, you know, socialist, fascist empire. And they're going to come up with that anyway. I mean, he doesn't need to do anything for that to happen. So why not...
When he starts doing exactly the little, you know, when he really starts falling into these... doing these exactly the sorts of things that they've been predicting or lying about, that it, I don't know. I'm not saying that he needs to not do big, you know, big global things to, you know, so as not to be painted with these bullshit brushes. I don't know. It just seems all very, I don't know, ill-conceived.
Yeah. Well, they're just, you know what, the opposition is just pulling shit out of their ass. And you know, I don't think it's worthwhile to walk in eggshells around them. You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, here they are. He's got a Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. He's got a UN ambassador, Susan Rice. And they happen to be women. And when they push for enforcing a no-fly zone, suddenly it's, you know, these like Long Island Yentas henpecking the president into, you know, enforcing no fly zone. It's all the women are being bolder than the gay commander in chief. I mean, and make no mistake. I mean, that's the entire meme. I mean, they just want to make the president seem, oh, he's gay.
Nuanced.
That's nuanced as gay. Yeah. And if even the women are more war hawkish than he is, he must really be gay. I mean, he must be super gay. I mean, he must be Rip Taylor gay. Like, he's going to appear, you know, in his next Oval Office address, and he's going to shoot confetti out of a bucket.
I'd pay to see that.
Yeah, with a big, you know, cheesy mustache. I mean, that's how they're trying to paint him. Yeah. And to try to kind of fix that by saying, well, maybe they should make it seem as if all the men are making decisions in the White House, or maybe they should, you know, I just don't understand why, you know, they're just going to keep up with this cavalcade of bullshit regardless of anything the president does. So finding a way around that is impossible.
I mean, the core of my issue is that, like I said, I don't know. It's not about, oh, what's the end game? It's not all this armchair quarterback bullshit about what's our exit strategy and blah, blah, blah. It's none of that. It's just, I don't know who it is we're backing up here. I don't know for sure that the very small number of these guys, the armed resistance, is really actually very small compared to what Gaddafi's got on the ground. I don't know who they are. I don't know what they want. I don't know what the vacuum leaves behind. I don't know. It's not as clear cut as in some of these other places that have infrastructure. Like Tunisia and Egypt had a functional societal, social, union-based, civil infrastructure. They've got these things. Libya doesn't have any of that. It's very much like Iraq in its compartmentalization, and it's fucking just infrastructure is about to collapse. It doesn't have any social structure. Gaddafi did away with all of that. So I don't know what happens when I just don't think that Gaddafi getting booted out or shot or blown up, then it's just like, okay, you know, here you go, guys, and have fun. Yeah. I think that leaves a massive vacuum in Northern Africa, and I think Saudi Arabia is the real problem in all of this. Is Saudi Arabia sitting there bordered on all sides by this complete cluster fuckery, and no one seems to be paying attention to I don't know. I think it's just a fucking mess, yeah. And I don't want this president hanging himself with imperial, this neo-imperialistic trauma that happens every time we take any sort of military action against an Arab nation.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
I don't see this particular Pentagon and this particular White House allowing that to happen or getting involved in a situation that in which that could actually occur. I mean, certainly there's a chance. I mean, there's a chance of it all going to hell. I mean, we never know. We never know what's around the next bend. But I think it's been calculated and gamed out to such a degree that they never would have gotten involved if they couldn't look the American people in the eye within months and say, look at this. Everything is much better. And here's the contrast between how smart policy is executed and how dumb policy is executed, because those other guys
I'll absolutely concede that whatever it is they're doing, it's smarter and more, and better considered and better wargamed than anything, the neocons did in the 8 years of Bush clusterfuckery. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But that's not necessarily an excuse for doing it in the first place. And I love that, we're not it's sort of the absolute opposite of what the neocon, the neocon theory was, which is bully and threaten. I mean, Rumsfeld threatened other countries and other leaders basically political blackmail to become these coalition partners, these coalition of the willing, bullshit partners. We're doing absolutely the opposite of that now. Which is saying, yeah, we'll get involved if you foot the bill and you put more skin in this game to other countries now. That's great. And it's absolutely smarter, but I don't know that that's an excuse to do it, at all.
Yeah.
So, well, time will tell. We'll see. I just didn't want this president to be, that guy.
I mean, that's the instinct. I mean, everyone kind of knee-jerked. I mean, the usual suspects kind of knee-jerked into, oh, here we go, third war. Barack Obama said he wasn't going to do this or that, and now here he is doing it. Well, it's not – first of all, it's not any different than what any other president has done throughout modern or recent history. I mean, it's just something – It's something that presidents generally do, and that doesn't make it necessarily wise. But I think if you look at the details of what the president has done, I think it could be it could end up being a very smart decision. And then there's so many circumstances that are different between what's happening now and what happened with the previous president that they're innumerable. I mean, it's not there's no similarity whatsoever. Maybe in terms of the similarities in infrastructure, as you were detailing there about Iraq versus Libya. But, I mean, beyond that, as far as a military action, there's must be zero. I can't think of a similarity between Iraq and this.
I'm not one of these. I'm not being firebaggery on this and saying, oh, it's Iraq 2 and it's just, oh, Jesus Christ and blah, blah. I'm just, no, that's not my point at all. I've said all my reasons. It's just, I'm not running around with my hair on fire, and I'm certainly not questioning the constitutionality and all that. No one seems to understand this president wouldn't do jack shit. They've got a legal office in this White House, so they just have to go downstairs and go, hey, look, I'm thinking about joining up with this UN thing, sending some planes over there. Am I going to get impeached for that? And I think they pay folks to go to look at the rules and go, no, you're fine. Yeah. So I don't understand what people think that President Obama just wakes up one day, fuck all this government stuff and all this constitution. I'm pretty sure they got their bases covered there. So I'm just trying to be more realistic about the overall outcome and the region and the impression that this leaves with the – I want the Arab world to think that this guy is not on their side. That's the wrong message, but that – America's knee-jerk reaction to their problems is not to come over and drop bombs on people, regardless of how – it doesn't matter how surgical you are and how precise and one blown-up wedding, one stray missile that goes and lands on a nursery school, and that's it. You just – you're fucked. You just created a whole new batch of asshole, and that's just – I don't want that hanging over this president's head in that region, not here at home, over there.
Right. Well, there are two indications that prove to me that the opposition to this action is extraordinarily weak. And we'll get to those after the soap.
Soap.
I need more soap. We're running through the bonbons quite rapidly. In their strawberry goodness. So we desperately need some more soap. So I'm looking forward to the next delivery from Bubble Genius, the exclusive sponsor of the Bubble Genius Bob and Elvis show. And I don't think I give out the website address enough, but mainly, why? That's because it's everywhere. You just go to the website and click on the various banners and it'll take you right to Bubble Genius. And if you know what's good for you, you'll buy all of your soap, bath and body products from BubbleGenius.com. And new commercial from Bubble Genius, as always, and we're going to play that right now.
Sandra Day O'Connor, Bernadette Peters, Harriet Tubman, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Ann Miller, my mom, her mom, my sisters. It's Women's History Month, and Bubble Genius celebrates awesome babes the world over who've made our Earth a better place.
Elizabeth Warren, Tallulah Bankhead, Rachel Maddow, Jermaine Greer, C.L. Chapman, Rosalind Carter, Sally Ride, Jane Goodall, Abigail Adams, Vivian Westwood. A great big huzzah to all the women who've made a difference in our lives, who've taken the bullshit by the horns to make all of our lives better. Give the awesome broad in your life a Venus soap from Bubble Genius.
Anita Franco,
Liz Taylor,
Shirley Temple Black,
B. Arthur,
Michelle Obama,
Gypsy Rose Lee,
Amelia Earhart,
Pam Greer,
Madeline Albright,
Tina Weymouth,
Mae West,
Jacqueline Bouvier, Kennedy Onassis,
Grandma Moses,
Barbara Streisand,
Mary Cassatt,
Nancy Pelosi,
Lucille Ball,
Margaret Mead,
Marian Anderson,
Lillian Hellman,
Susan B. Anthony,
Mary Shelley,
Louisa May Alcott,
Molly Ivins,
buy our stuff!
BubbleGenius.com.
Ayn Rand. Just kidding.
No!
Shove Bob and Elvis into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go.
Do it!
Subscribe to the Bob and Elvis Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
Make sure to enter your promo code, Bob and Elvis, BOBANDELVIS. Get 15% off your entire order at BubbleGenius.com. Yeah, Ayn Rand. That was funny there at the end.
Yeah.
Although, was she an American citizen? I don't think she was. Was she? I thought she was British.
Mm.
I don't remember. I don't know enough about Ayn Rand.
Maybe we should. If I was Stranahan, I could answer that.
I was just going to say, he went to an objectivist high school, from what I recall.
Apparently, yeah.
So he knows probably more about Ayn Rand than Ayn Rand knows about Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm.
God. Well, that's a whole other can of worms. I'll get to that in a little bit. There's a whole sort of now, there's a Breitbart, Stranahan, O'Keefe, perhaps Huffington kind of industrial
super
complex.
Yeah.
Arising. We'll discuss that in a little bit. But that was going back to what we were talking about before the break, is the two indications to me that the arguments against the president's action in Libya are really thin. Now, the whole idea of impeaching the president because of Libya is utter bullshit.
Yeah,
I mean, it's complete. Anyone saying that the president ought to be impeached because of this is just an unserious doof.
Yeah.
And that includes Denis Kucinich, who we've kind of indicated is one of the most unserious of the unserious doofs.
Yeah. There's something wrong with that guy.
Yeah. I mean, when
just look at it. There's something wrong with that guy. That's all I can say. He's just got a fuse blown in that weird head of his.
Well, I couldn't believe it. I mean, he's just every turn he plays into the stereotype of himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He just self-satirizes Denis Kucinich is what he does. He's gonna sue the congressional cafeteria. He actually did sue the congressional cafeteria because he bit into an olive that had a pit in it.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's kind of broke. Dennis. I think he cracked a tooth or something on that. We don't go gnawing into olives without just giving it a little nibble to make sure there's not a pit in there.
I actually did that the other day. I went to Whole Foods and they've got the olive bar, you know?
Yeah.
The big pasta and olive and salad bar thing. And they've got all the exotic olives. And so I put like one layer down of just what I thought was regular olives. And on the top layer, there's various layers because it's all one price, like $7.99 a pound. And so the top was these great big giganda monster olives stuffed with blue cheese. But I packed it so full that I couldn't get the lid on. So I had to eat a couple in the store, which would reduce the weight and save me money, which was nice. So I was stealing olives basically.
Yeah.
And, I had like two off the top and then the third one it wasn't one of these blue cheese ones. It had a pit in it. I almost broke a tooth off. Cause I was being so repetitious. I was trying to be so sneaky and I wanted to just woof it down before I got caught by the, you know, the Whole Foods salad bar police and just went, oh, fuck my tooth. It really just about crushed my tooth.
Yeah. I mean, but again, it's an olive. They sometimes have a pit in it. It's like you go, if you go to the beach and you get stung by a jellyfish, you're not going to like, oh, God damn, that stupid ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, you go into the beach, you're expecting
something sharp.
There's a chance there's going to be something weird in the ocean. Likewise, there's a chance if you bite into an olive, there's going to be a pit in it. There might not be. Some of them are seedless, or pitted, but some others do have a pit in it. Sorry, Dennis.
Sorry, Dennis.
Ridiculous. But then the other thing. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just saying, when Nebraska had, for the very first time in the 2008 election, Nebraska became a primary state. I mean, a caucus state. And it had always been a primary state, so nobody really knew how to caucus. And we all came out to our local gymnasium or whatever, our local town hall, which all the rednecks, all the wing nuts are so proud of. And the capstone at the top of the building, the foundings, like the stone that was etched when it was built, shows that it was a WPA project, basically, a New Deal taxpayer money project, and none of them seem to know that. But anyway, we all gathered there, and there was a Hillary faction and an Obama faction, and there was about six people that were there for Denis Kucinich. And the funniest thing about it was so we all had to get up and give. I was the guy that presented for Obama, and then there's Hillary people got up, and then but the Kucinich crew, the guy that they elected or the guy that they chose during the caucus to present the Kucinich platform couldn't pronounce Kucinich. So he announced, so he did the whole thing just saying Dennis. Dennis thinks.
Dennis.
Dennis does. Dennis, I was just laughing my ass off in the back. Because I know he's looking at the script and seeing that last name and just like, oh, I know I'm going to fuck that up. So it's just like first name basis. Well, Dennis believes in this healthcare. That was priceless.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I was just going to say, supporting Denis Kucinich for president is like supporting Chewbacca for president. It's a complete waste of time.
Is Chewbacca running?
Chewbacca is not running, but neither is Denis Kucinich. But I mean, I still see Denis Kucinich like bumper stickers around.
Chewbacca would kick some ass.
It totally would. Yeah, he'd rip an arms off a Gundark.
Ears.
Ears. Yeah. Ears off a Gundark.
I don't think Gundarks have arms.
No, they don't. Sorry. But you know what's other? You know the other argument that's sort of a complete and utter fantasy is this argument that the president should have gone to Congress for a formal declaration of war. I mean, you talk about a wasted breath. Yeah. I mean, I said on the blog. I mean, you might as well argue the existence of hobbits. It's I mean, it's a complete waste of time. And it shows to me, you got nothing else. Is that all you have? You can say, oh, we're gonna talk about how, you know, whether or not the president had congressional authority to do this. Since when did that matter? Since when has any president since Franklin Roosevelt done that?
Yeah, I seem to remember. Yeah, it's yeah. You know, at the end of the day, if you'd done that, we'd still be talking about it, and nothing would have ever happened, and they'd just, you know, we'd have no part in it. So, I don't know. Apparently he's got some limited authority to do things the way he wants to do it in certain areas, and this is one of them. So, like I said, I'm never ever going to lose sleep over the constitutionality of anything comes out of this White House. I sleep comfortably at night knowing that that's the one thing I don't have to worry about.
Yeah,
it's constitutionality.
Right. I mean, you have a constitutional scholar in the White House. You're going to be hard pressed to prove something's unconstitutional that he's doing.
Yeah, and with the Supreme Court, I mean, the checks and balances were, if he does, hey, I'll be the first to say, if he does something unconstitutional, call him on it and throw him out because of it. That's why we have the system we have.
That's exactly
checks
right.
Checks and balances. If checks and balances don't work with my president, then they would never, you know, then I have to worry that they just don't work at all. And that's the whole point of our government is checks and balances. So if he does something unconstitutional, then fuck him. He should go to jail, or he should be impeached, or whatever happens there. So that's why I don't worry about
this. And it should be the real Constitution, not the fake Sarah Palin Constitution.
Right, not the one that they make up and add words to or subtract words from.
Amendment 10, you know, not recognizing what's that there actually are articles in there, too, and not just amendments.
Yeah,
I think a lot of wingnuts forget that there are articles in the Constitution. They just think it's the Bill of Rights, and there's some other mumbo jumbo that comes after the first 10. And then that's it. It's like the end. This is the end of the Constitution.
Yeah.
And there are no articles in there that enumerate various things like, you know, taxes.
Well, I got into an argument with a wingnut on one of these boards once where she literally said that if it's not in the Constitution, it's the law is unconstitutional. It's meaningless. Like she didn't, I was trying to say, do you understand that there's something called the United States Code, USC, right? That's where all federal law is. That's where all the law is in USC, the United States Code. It's this gigantic book of all the laws that Congress has passed since basically go.
Yeah.
And that's where the laws that really, that drive our society, that protect us and do all these things are codified in USC. And she goes, the Constitution supersedes it all. As I mean, they honestly don't understand how it works. They don't understand how government works at all.
They don't.
She denied the fact that USC, that the United States Code existed. She, absolutely insane person. You cannot talk to these people.
Yeah.
You can't reason with them or show them facts.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no fact-based universe for them anymore. It's, oh, no, no. It's not in the Constitution. And then the endless debate about originalism versus the living Constitution. The founders really, to some extent, really fucked us, I think. They could have been a little clearer.
Yeah.
They should have been, you know, one right at the end where they dovetail it in and say, oh, by the way, all of this completely changeable. We know 200 years from now, things are going to be really different. So do whatever you want, really.
Exactly. Well,
that would have helped.
How many constitutions have actually endured for, you know, two centuries? I mean, never. It's unprecedented. And I think that's what they were considering. It'll be vague, so what you can do is you can interpret it based upon the advancement and development of this country and this economy.
But there's dicks like Scalia who, oh, no. Originalism, period. Mm-hmm. It's not a living document at all.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So let's all go back to, you know, owning slaves and white and women can't vote and, you know, everything else. It's, but it really is amazing that it's as unamended as it is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the fact that there's so few amendments over that long a period of time is a real testament to that document. Mm-hmm. Is a real testament to that, to the, you know, just the resiliency and really how far thinking they were.
And also how goddamn difficult it is to actually amend the Constitution. I mean, it's not easy. I can't imagine that 2/3 of the United States would vote for anything right now.
Oh, no, no. Oh, no. We could never get a constitutional amendment in this. It's probably never, ever going to happen again. I mean, really, 2/3? No way. Mm-hmm. No way in hell.
No. No. And you know what? And then going back to what you were saying about arguing with these people anymore, it doesn't – there's no – coherence to arguing back to them anymore. No. I mean, you know, we could bring up as many facts and as much reality, numbers, statistics as we want. And it doesn't matter anymore because all they're doing is like arguing against a brick wall. All they're doing is coming up with positions that are just the opposite of what the Democrats and the president are saying. That's all it is. And there's no greater evidence of that than Newt Gingrich. This week.
Oh, God.
I mean, this is no greater example because this is exactly, and he just stumbled into making it really fucking transparent.
Yeah.
And easy to see because he's such an idiot. Well, he's not an idiot. He's kind of a smart guy, but I don't know why it makes him look like an idiot when he's this. I think he forgets that there's a videotape and there's the internet.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, here he said one day prior to the action,
what
he says,
you do about Libya?
He says this to Greta Van Susteren.
Exercise a no-fly zone this evening. Communicate to the Libyan military that Gaddafi was gone and that the sooner they switched sides, the more likely they were to survive. Provided help to the rebels to replace him. The idea that we're confused about a man who has been an anti-American dictator since 1969 just tells you how inept this administration is. They were very quick to jump on Mubarak, who was their ally for 30 years, and they're confused about getting rid of Gaddafi. This is a moment to get rid of him. Do it. Get it over with.
And why do you think you think it's ineptitude is why the pause, or there's not movement, or different political,
look,
or
different
diplomacy?
I think the most generous comment would be ineptitude. It's also an ideological problem. The United States doesn't need anybody's permission. We don't need to have NATO, who frankly won't bring much to the fight. We don't need.
Okay, so that's, you get the idea. That's Newt Gingrich on March 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Newt Gingrich on March 23rd. All right.
I would not have intervened. I think there were a lot of other ways to affect Gaddafi. I think there were a lot
what
of allies
fuck?
In the region that we could have worked with. I would not have used American and European forces.
I mean, that's unbelievable.
Standard has fallen back.
I mean, he...
That is just absolutely... unbelievable.
So just to recap, March 7th, totally in favor of doing everything the administration is doing now. Mm-hmm. And then March 23rd, 16 days later, he's totally against it. He's yeah. I would not have intervened. You know, 16 days early, I'm totally in intervening. 16 days later, I would not have intervened.
I would never intervene.
How do you come up with, and you know, I give these guys a lot of credit because they tried. I mean, Talking Points Memo actually gathered together a bunch of sort of political scholars to try to piece apart Newt Gingrich's Facebook response to his just bald-faced hypocrisy. Yeah. And, you know, that's fine. But coming up with some sort of coherence to any of it is just, I mean, it's such a red herring. It's a blind alley because all they do is say the opposite. I mean, that's all you got to say. Well, they're just, you know, they have nothing else other than to just say the opposite of what, you know, it's like that scene. I don't know if you've seen that movie, The Paper. It's one of my favorite movies. This is a Ron Howard movie called The Paper with Michael Keaton. And it's just got this huge cast. Glenn Close is in it. Mira Sorvino is in it. And Robert Duvall plays the editor of this, you know, New York newspaper, this sort of tabloid newspaper, New York Daily News type newspaper. And they're having a debate. I mean, Michael Keaton, his character, is debating Glenn Close's character. And all they're doing is basically saying the opposite of what the other one's doing. And Robert Duvall is the editor, this grisly editor with prostate cancer, jumps in and says, Stop acting like a bunch of kindergartners. You're just saying the opposite of what the other one is saying. Shut the fuck up. And that's all you hear from the Republicans anymore, is just this petulant, you know, we're just going to do all, our only position is what the opposite of their position is. So how do you possibly begin to take them seriously enough to be able to even start to debunk what they have to say? There's no debunking of what they say because there's no substance to it. In order to debunk something, there has to be something. There has to be bunk there.
Bunk, yeah.
And there is no bunk, so there is no debunking. You can't remove the bunk if there's no bunk in the first place.
But isn't bunk... Shouldn't it just be bunking? Isn't bunk bad in the first place?
Yeah, bunk is bullshit, isn't it? Bunk,
if you
like...
debunk, you're... That sounds wrong.
Yeah, we can look up. I'm going to look up bunk.
Bunk.
And see what we're talking about here. Bunk.
I've got to debunk that.
Bunk.
Yeah. All they've got is bunk. You can't debunk it.
Bunk, right?
No, if it's all. Yeah, no, that's right. If it's all bunk, then you have to debunk it, but then there'd just be nothing left. It's just
okay.
All bunk.
Bunk is a noun.
Bunk.
Meaning
it's just one of those words.
Nonsense.
Bunk.
Yeah.
Say it over
bunk.
And over again. Bunk.
Bunk. It actually means nonsense. So if you debunk
right.
it,
you're denonsensing it. Yeah.
Yeah. You're denonsensing
something.
Exactly.
Debunking.
So there's
bunk.
Right. Synonyms. I don't get the synonyms. The synonyms are applesauce, balderdash, baloney, bilge, claptrap, eyewash, flimflam.
Applesauce.
Applesauce was the first one. I guess because it's alphabetical.
Man, that's old. That's like a 1920s kind of a thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Applesauce.
Oh, applesauce. Oh, horse feathers. Horse hockey. Colonel Potter used to say, horse hockey.
I hated Potter.
You hated Potter? Yeah.
I hated all the first two or three years of after they lost the first colonel.
Henry.
Henry Blake.
Yeah.
And after they lost
Frank Burns,
totally in the toilet.
Yeah,
as far as I'm concerned, it got preachy and Witherspoon or whatever the fuck his name was. The other guy, the guy that replaced Blake.
Oh,
Frank Burns was just.
Oh yeah, you didn't like Wingy. You weren't a fan of Winchester.
Winchester.
Yeah.
That's it. It's been so long since I've watched MASH, but the first couple of years, there's never been anything funnier.
Yeah.
Than the first couple of years of MASH. Absolutely priceless.
Well, I mean, I think even some of the early BJ years were good.
Yeah. The early BJ years. Yeah.
Yeah.
BJ was, I actually preferred BJ to Trapper.
Yeah.
I think when I was a kid. But now as an adult, it's funny how your attitudes change when you're an adult. You know, like when I was a kid, I was all about Roger Moore as James Bond.
I think. I think you're the only Roger Moore as Bond fan.
Because he was my first. I don't think I ever saw a – I moved around too much and spent too much time in Europe to be sitting in front of American rerun TV. Like we got – the kind of TV I got just didn't have a lot of old American movies on. So and this is pre-VHS, right? So I was really never exposed to Connery.
Between your luge lessons.
My luge and my testicle shaving, yeah. the very first Bond movie I ever saw in the theater was Octopussy. Mm-hmm. And I was just enchanted with just the idea of Bond. I mean, it was the first Bond movie I ever saw in the theater. And then I went back and got all then we get cable and it's like the TNT the marathons they'd run. And it was Moonraker and Spy Who Loved Me. I mean, the early Live and Let Die, the early Moore Bond movies were pretty good. But when he got really super old with the giant hair and the movies just got really shitty,
yeah.
then it was just bad. But now I'm a diehard Connery fan. So
yeah.
It's just funny to go back and review. Like, have you ever watched an episode of $6 Million Man as an adult?
No, I can't say.
It's painful. Wasn't it your favorite show when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Of course.
I mean, I remember the most badass thing in the world as a kid. I mean, this is really like the epitome of badassness.
What?
Was $6 Million Man fighting Bionic Bigfoot.
Oh, fuck yeah.
And just the coolest goddamn thing ever. And bionic, I mean, it wasn't only Bigfoot, it was bionic Bigfoot.
It turned out to be bionic. We didn't know that.
Yeah.
He was like chasing, it was a two-parter, and he was chasing Bigfoot through the whole episode, and then they fight in the woods, and he rips Bigfoot's arm off, and it's bionic, and we all shit our pants.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And then there was the one with the Mars rover. There was like a spaceship that he had to fight, and that was a two-parter. And I used to cry. I used to get so into $6 Million Man. When it was a two-parter, I would cry.
At the end of the first part.
When it said, to be continued, I would start crying. I would start wailing. Because I had to have my $6 Million Man. And I was just, oh, no, fuck. Oh, and, you know, I have a special affinity for Lee Majors. But I can't really say why, but I have a special affinity for him. And, that show now I watch it as an adult and I'm like, oh, motherfuck.
Yeah.
This is an awful, awful show.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If you go back and you go to YouTube, because it's right there on YouTube, you go look at the fight. I mean, the fight between, Lee Majors and Bionic Bigfoot, between Steve Austin and Bionic Bigfoot. It's the most ridiculous fight in the world. It's like that episode. I mean, again, Star Trek is becoming a theme here in this particular episode of the show, but the fight between Kirk and the Gorn was totally badass as a kid.
Oh.
And now you go back and look at it. It's like this slow motion ballet of bullshit. Worst.
And you can see the zipper up the back of that fucking thing.
Yeah, there's
like the worst costume ever.
Slow moving lizard man with the gold lame tunic. It's just like the most ridiculous enemy in the world. And he
left over from some Spartacus movie.
He fashions a cannon out of rocks and a stick of bamboo.
Yeah.
And they're like, as
that's
a kid.
A great line in Galaxy Quest, though, when guys like, yeah. can you make a makeshift lathe?
Of lathe. Is there, can you find anything around to make a rudimentary lathe?
A rudimentary lathe. Oh my God, I love that.
But as a kid, it just looked totally kick ass.
He's
Kirk fighting his Gorn.
There was a Gorn action figure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, and the best toy ever, and I came this close the other day to buying one on eBay that was still in its box, was the $6 Million Man command module. It was like a rocket that opened up into like a bionic surgical center. Oh, my fuck. That was the best toy ever. And the Steve Austin doll had – did you have one? It had latex.
Yeah.
It had like a rubber arm. It was an action figure, but his like the arm skin rolled up.
It would roll
and
up.
There were bionic, right? You could roll it all the way up, and there were bionic inserts in his arm. I thought that was the coolest goddamn thing ever. You could take his bionics out, and you could look through his head. Mm-hmm. Remember, he had his eye hole.
Yeah.
Drilled through his head, and it had like crosshairs.
And there was a little magnifying glass in there, so everything was closer. Yeah. If you look through Steve Austin's head.
Yeah.
Everything was
he had a giant red button on his back that he could lift that engine block.
That's right.
It came with a little plastic engine block, and you push on that button, and it would go. And I used to run around my backyard. My parents, for Easter one year, I got this really slick white corduroy jacket. And I don't know why I thought that was totally Steve Austin, but I did. So I put this white corduroy jacket on, and I would transform into a $6 Million Man. I'd run around my backyard in slow motion going – me and like 10 million other kids were out in their backyards running in slow motion going.
Yeah. And then you
that was my whole life just being Steve Austin.
Go and make meat helmets.
And have my testicle shit.
Yeah, I mean, I had the Steve Austin action figure. He rolled up the rubber sleeve on his arm, so it was like he had to reveal the bionic arm. And then I also had the action figure for Maskatron. Remember, there was one enemy called Maskatron.
I totally had Maskatron.
Yeah,
I remember the day that I got Maskatron. I've never been so excited in my life. The guy had three different heads.
Yeah,
like turn and you could put mask on, and he had different arm gizmos. Oh, Maskatron was badass. That was a great toy, Maskatron. I'm going to go fucking get these things on eBay.
Yeah, you totally get them.
Because Peanuts needs to see the kind of stuff that I – and Maskatron can totally terrify the Barbies in this house. He can just clean up this Barbie disaster. We just Maskatron's in town now, babies.
And then what I think of is 40-year-old Virgin, where they go up to that shelf. He's got all his action figures out, and Seth Rogen goes – Is that Steve Austin's boss? He had the Oscar action figure up there.
I had that. Here's a tragic story from my childhood. Oscar Goldman came with an exploding briefcase. It was a two-sided – it was a little plastic briefcase. And the trick was that if you turn the handle clockwise, it would open up and there'd be Oscar Goldman's briefcase. It had files, OSS files in or OSI, whatever. It had the files in it and it had papers and stuff. But if – and then you loaded it back up, it was spring-loaded. If you turned it counterclockwise, it exploded. Like it would, you know, like confetti and shit would come out of it. It would, and everything inside would look burned up. Yeah. It was like a trick thing, two sided. And I left it in the back seat, in the mirror, in the window, the part, you know, in the back of a car with the window, is a little ledge up there. I left it back there when I was visiting my grandparents. My grandfather bought it for me, and I left it up behind the window in his Buick. And this was in like August in Mississippi. So the fucking thing melted.
Oh,
I mean, just absolutely turned to slag when I got back. We were gone for like 2 hours, came back, and my Oscar Goldman exploding briefcase was curled up like a – just like a fucking – just a mess. And I – oh, my God. I cried and cried. I was so traumatized by that.
Yeah.
I never got it back. I never got a new Oscar Goldman exploding briefcase.
Well, you know what? There's this great story from the Japanese tsunami. And I don't know if you I posted something about it on the blog. The guy's name is Hideki Akaiwa.
Okay.
And he's literally like the Steve Austin of Japan. I wouldn't be surprised if they open him up and he's bionic.
That'd be awesome.
Because yeah, I mean if you read this story, I mean here's the upshot of what this guy did. I mean, so the tsunami strikes in Miyagi Prefecture, right? Uh-huh. And his wife, this guy, he discovers that his wife is trapped in their house under like 10 feet of water.
Wow.
So somehow Hideki Akaiwa finds himself scuba gear in the midst of all of this chaos. He tracks down scuba gear, gets a scuba gear on, dives into the water as the water is rising, you know. The tsunami waters are still roiling all around. There's whirlpools and there's shit floating in it. There's cars and houses. I mean, there's literally like, you know, the water is so strong that houses are being moved off of their foundations. And we've all seen the video today. This guy dives in with his scuba gear, his tank, and he's got the goggles and the fins and everything. Makes his way to his house. And you know, through all of this hideous and awful mess in the water and goes into the house. He's underwater, finds his wife who is still alive, struggling to breathe, provides her with
She struggling to breathe underwater?
Well, there's like an air pocket, I guess, if she's up floating around up near the ceiling. Oh. Is from what I gather. Okay. And the water's rising, so she's very close to drowning at this point because there's less and less oxygen up there.
Mm.
Now, it's like that scene from Indiana Jones where they're in that coffin. There's like an air
Crimson
pocket.
Tide. Yeah. Any, exactly. Or any movie where there's ever been water and yeah.
So Hideki Akaiwa rescues his wife, leads her to safety, like swims her out of there with his scuba suit, transferring the scuba breathing apparatus over to her so she can breathe, rescues her. And then realizes that his mother is trapped in her house.
Oh, my God.
So he dives back into the water and goes in and manages to rescue his mother.
Mm.
And pulls his mother out of the water. And rescues his mother. I mean, you've got to go read this story. I linked to it on the blog. It's I'm not doing it justice. But I'm going to read the last couple of paragraphs from the LA Times description of the piece. Hideki Akaiwa pokes around in his car, battered and likely ruined by the tsunami, pointing out a 3-inch fishing fish lying dead almost half a mile inland, one of the tsunami's smallest victims. Then he adjusts his pants, reaches into a still wet car, and pulls out a pair of Ray-Ban aviator glasses from a light brown case, pours out the seawater, and puts them on to complete his outfit before mounting the bicycle he's using since his wheels were disabled. Akaiwa next reviews the contents of his fanny pack, green tea, water, a flashlight, camouflage, work gloves, a Swiss Army-style knife, and a change of clothes. Finally, he adjusts the grip on his bicycle, heads off in search of other trapped survivors. Sorry, I have to get going, he says, as he navigates around the dead fish, through a puddle and around the corner.
Wow.
With his fucking Ray-Ban sunglasses out of the glove compartment of his goddamn car.
He's Japanese MacGyver. He's got everything in that little fanny pack.
He rescued his mother, rescued his wife. He's in that tsunami water with scuba gear on. Jesus.
Badass. If anybody's got a bionic dude, it's the Japanese, though.
Yeah.
He must not be bionic if he needed scuba gear, though. He said bionic people can just swim underwater.
Yeah, he's not a – yeah, he's got –
we're getting close to that. We're going to have bionics someday, like $6 million man. I mean, I know we've got primitive bionics now, basically, but, I mean – we're going to have $6 million man style bionics soon. I want to see some dude running like super fat. That's one thing I never got. Like, I wanted to see Steve Austin like really booking it, you know, like really just zooming. And it was all in slow motion. And it kind of took away from it for me.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they can only do so much. He really books it on the treadmill in the opening theme there.
Yeah, but I want to, and there's one scene where he's out on the street. Mm-hmm. Chugging it, but that didn't do it for me.
No, it's just all the slow motion stuff. But, you know, what can you do? It's the 1970s.
Yeah.
And if you go back and look at it now, yeah, it looks sucky.
It's
really
awful.
Really, really awful.
Oh, God, it's awful. So disappointing.
Today's show brought to you by Bubble Genius, of course. More stuff to talk about in the show here. I think we're running a little late, but that's okay. Pure products, pure genius, Bubble Genius at www.bubblegenius.com. Hilarious, all-natural, eco-friendly products for bath, body, and mental well-being. The coolest soap and body care stuff you've ever seen. It's the best goddamn soap in the world, and I'm serious about that. If you haven't tried it yet, you're really missing out. And they've got tons of varieties, and of course, all of their various specials, all of their themed specials. For example, this week is Women's History Month, as we learned about before. Who would you say, Elvis, is probably the greatest woman in American history?
As far as I'm concerned?
Yeah. I mean, if you had to choose the greatest woman in American history, who would it be?
Oh, Lord. That's a fucking... Ask me again after the commercial.
Okay.
I have to think about that. Because, I mean, it breaks... To my mind, it breaks down into eras and in specific accomplishments.
Yeah.
Like, as it would with any man, I guess. So, I don't know. Let me think about it.
Yeah. I mean, if I had to choose one, just right off the top of my head, I'd just say, like, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I'd say Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks, yeah.
I'm just a civil rights nut. So. Yeah. I mean, a woman that, I mean, she really literally, Rosa Parks started it all. I mean, that the bus boycott and all that, I mean, it just, she just said, fuck you, Whitey. And I wish I knew who that guy was. Like, I'd like to go piss on that guy's grave. The guy that wanted her to get up so he could sit down.
Yeah.
Piece of shit. Well, I mean, what a dick.
Yeah, that's right.
What an absolute dick. Some white guy. This woman's been working her ass off all day. And he's like, yeah, why don't you get up? Because I got to sit down. Fuck you, Whitey. Oh, my God. What a dick.
Yeah.
I hope he died a really uncomfortable death. I really do.
Well, speaking of uncomfortable deaths, Easter is coming up. And
yes, it is. Zombie holiday.
Yeah. And make sure to buy all of your Easter gifts at Bubble Genius, and they're non-sugary. I mean, it's like you can get Easter-themed products that won't rot your teeth out or make you all tubby. It's still Caffeine Awareness Month, so make sure to get their Bathachino Sugar Scrub. By the way, more wars, so make sure to buy a soldier a shower, which you can do at Bubble Genius, where you buy buy various soap products, and they package it all together and send it to the troops in the field.
Yeah, do that.
Bubble Genius brings you soap and body products like you've never seen before. They've got something for everyone, from guys to girls to kitties to expecting mothers and even your best friend, which is your dog. They even have a few things for your home. And Bubble Genius strives to be good to your skin while also being good to the planet. I almost choked there. This will be the first time on the show that I've almost actually choked. Most of their packaging is recyclable. They source their ingredients as close to home as possible, thereby supporting other local and domestic businesses while cutting down on fossil fuel consumption. By not having stuff shipped from across the globe, they do their best to use organic ingredients when they're accessible and affordable. And their soaps are free of chemical detergents and surfactants. And make sure to check out their sale items at bubblegenius.com/sale.html. Pure products, pure genius, bubblegenius at bubblegenius.com.
The following podcast contains harsh language.
What? What? Shut. That is the wrong button. God damn it. Damn it. How about this? Yeah.
The Bob and Elvis Show.
Exactly is what you were supposed to say. So.
Yeah, Eleanor Roosevelt is a good choice, but she was constantly hindered by FDR. She would have made a better president than FDR in some ways. Like, she was all about she hated his reluctance on civil rights. She was way out there on civil rights. She was way out there on women's rights. She was just so much more. I mean, and FDR is this liberal icon, but she was even more wacko liberal, way left progressive than he was. And if he had, and they hated each, I mean, they didn't hate each other, but they certainly didn't have sex ever. And he was having an affair on her, and she knew it. And I mean, it's a fascinating relationship, complicated, fascinating relationship. But yeah, I mean, that's a hell of a woman. She'd kick your ass too.
That's
great, big broad. She would fuck you up.
Yeah,
she'd cut a bitch. But for my money, it's Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as far as just really effecting massive change from a core of just utter balls out bravery and principle.
Yeah,
I mean, she just stood the fuck up, and that, I mean, that's and just the absolute shitstorm that followed, the real change in this country, gradual but real. I think I got to go with Rosa Parks.
Yeah, as far as personal accomplishments go, I mean, you know what? This is going to kind of sound weird, but you know who has kicked serious ass in her time is Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, well, sure.
I'm not making that up. I mean, you talk about breaking through. I mean, as a black woman.
Oh, yeah.
Breaking through so many glass ceilings. I mean, she's literally like the wealthiest person in media.
In media,
if not maybe not one of the wealthiest people in the United States. No, I don't think they go that far. No. But I mean, she has been
certainly
able to
the wealthiest women, and you know, single women, and to have done it just completely on her own terms, by just in her own, that's quite a story.
Yeah,
I mean, that's an empire. That's a built from scratch empire.
I think Hillary Clinton's got to be way up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the way I think the way Jackie Onassis came out of the tragedy of that presidency.
Multiple tragedies. Yeah. I mean, just the absolute shit kicking she took over just the court. I mean, just that summer, the summer before Jack got shot, she'd fucking had a stillbirth. I mean, lost a baby there, just in the summer before JFK got killed. I mean, just just one thing after another. Yeah, she was quite a woman. And the more I'm doing a lot of this Kennedy stuff, and the more I read about Jackie, I've been reading a couple books just on Jackie, and she was just a remarkable woman. Yeah. I mean, not at all what you think she would be like, having seen the clip. Because when she talked, she sounded like a fucking space cadet. Have you ever seen the the CBS footage of the tour she gave of the White House? Uh-huh. Where she's like, and this is the Roosevelt room. And she's like chewing gum. It's like, you're like, what the fuck, Jackie?
Yeah.
It's like she's high as a kite. But she also looked like 20 years older than she was. Like, she was in her 30s, like her early to mid 30s. She was so young. And she was in her 20s when they got married. She was just way young and just sounded like a space cadet, but so, so smart and such an amazing parent, such an amazing mother. Mm-hmm. That's an American icon. And Abigail Adams, I mean, if we're going to go way back.
Oh, yeah.
Abigail Adams had – it was just – I don't know if you've ever read the compiled letters of between Abigail and John Adams, but, I mean, that was a remarkable one.
Yeah, exactly.
For her time and for her social status. I mean, she basically just ran that. She ran that business, the Adams business. I mean, it's like John wouldn't change his underwear without her fucking permission.
Yeah, and you know what? Come to think of it, you know who's really broken through a lot of barriers? And because it's so soon, it's you don't really think of her as being particularly – no, not Sarah Palin. We'll get to Sarah Palin in a minute.
Oh.
But you know who's remarkable and who's an invaluable resource, I think, not only to the media but to America in general, is Rachel Maddow.
Yeah.
I mean, just the
she's
way
a genius
she is. She's a genius, and the way she conducts that show, I don't think anyone else could do that show the way that she does that show.
She's the Edward R. Murrow of our time. I mean, I'm absolutely serious about
that. I agree.
That gets thrown around a lot from the liberal intelligentsia, at least. But she's absolutely that. They even have – I even did like a letter check. They've got the same number of letters in there. Anyway, she's the Edward R. Murrow by far of this generation. She's so young. She's got her whole career ahead of her to really affect some change. And once the country comes around a little bit, I mean, she's like a scary super journalist sent from the future. She's like, you know, liberal robototron from the year 3000. Mm-hmm. She's just playing so far ahead of the rest of it. Her guests can't keep up with her. It's frightening how good she is.
Well, when anyone kind of lumps her in, tries to compare her to, or try to find an analogous character on the right, there's no one like her on the right. There's no one like her on the left, for that matter.
No. She's peerless.
Yeah.
She's absolutely peerless.
Right.
You know, you'd think like a Lawrence O'Donnell, somebody with... I mean, I think she would bury Lawrence O'Donnell. I mean, that's how smart I think she is. I mean, you can't touch her. It's like put her and Pat Buchanan. It's like Einstein arguing physics with a baby. You know, it's just there's just no. And I'm not trying to gush just because she's. I just think she's just absolutely empirically amazing. Just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no one construct the way she's able to construct an argument and put together, you know, one of those extended, I don't know if you want to call them an essay or just this extended argument in support or against some policy.
Right.
Yeah. Is I mean, you don't really see. I mean, these things could be transcribed and used as memorandum for, you know, political purposes in the White House or any level of the administration.
Yeah. 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 I mean, she's clearly overjoyed with Wonk. I mean, like, yeah. She just loves it so much. There's such a passion for it. She just knows all the nitty gritty of it. I'm just in awe of her, really.
Yeah. And you just get a sense that it comes from a place of complete integrity. Like you don't think that she's being dishonest about anything because she doesn't allow herself to be on. She's been wrong.
And
she'll admit it. That's right. She comes back on the following night. As soon as she discovers that there's been an inaccuracy or some, you know, bit of information that slipped into her stream of information, she'll correct it right away.
Yeah. 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 It's all the political. I mean, like, I believe that Obermann has a lot of political passion. I know he does. I mean, you can see it, but it's stripped of all that bombast and all that unseriousness. Like, now that I don't think she's doing that idiot at the end of the show anymore, that douche, that completely deserioused the entire thing, right? It just took something away from it a little bit. Like, I just want her to be so laser focused on, you know, news and politics and that stuff. I don't want any distractions from that. And then every now and then she slips into goofiness, I think it's just like a steam valve just to let her, you know, otherwise her head might explode. But but it's stripped of all bombast and retardation and everything else that makes – I mean, she just runs circles around everybody, right and left. It's remarkable. I just hope she has a long and illustrious career. Yeah. We just don't put – we as a society, American people, don't put a premium on that kind of journalism anymore. I mean, it's just not – you know, it's one of the reasons, back to last week, one of the reasons why liberal radio failed. It's because it's that just all the time. And there's a threshold that the American public can take of that much, you know, wonkiness.
Yeah.
That much fact, you know. Her show is exactly long enough to handle.
Right. And she was, you know, she was on Air America. I mean, she had her own show on
Air
America.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the last people to have a show on Air America.
Yeah.
And she was, for the longest time, she was actually doing that show. She was doing 3 hours a day on Air America and the Rachel Maddow show.
Yeah.
At night. That's pretty remarkable. Considering the amount of information, the amount of research that goes into a single show on either end of the media spectrum.
Yeah.
It's just it's staggering. And by the way, so you have Rachel Maddow, who's at the sort of the pinnacle of political integrity and political discourse. And at the opposite end of that scale, you have Andrew Breitbart.
Yeah.
And so there's been a big a movement, kerfuffle, you know, about boycotting the Huffington Post because they've been allowing Andrew Breitbart to post, and then they feature his stuff on the, you know, on the blog. I mean, in that rundown on the left where all the blogs appear.
Yeah, yeah. Front page, yeah.
Yeah, front page.
They took him off today, didn't they?
I think they did, but only because he rotates out. I mean, they don't leave that stuff up there for very long. It sort of gets bumped down and gets just bumped right off the front page.
Yeah.
But, you know.
There's a huge backlash against that, though.
Yeah, yeah. I don't like it. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, I understand the mission statement of allowing, you know, all varieties of opinion onto the Huffington Post. Fine. But it should at least be, you know, information that comes from a place of honesty or some form of integrity. Yeah. Like, at least, I mean, even the people who are on there saying that, you know, we shouldn't vaccinate our kids and, you know, there's a lot of like weird pseudoscience happening at the Huffington Post. Even
but
that comes from some
there's
place.
There's integrity to that. I mean, those people believe that.
Exactly.
I don't think Breitbart believes a word he says.
Of course not.
When he says, I would vote for her in an instant, talking about Sarah Palin, I don't believe that.
No.
I don't believe that. I think he would stay home or vote for the other guy before he would literally cast a vote for Sarah Palin.
That's right.
He doesn't strike me as fucking retarded. He's just an opportunist. Mm-hmm. He's a circus three ring. You know, he's the guy in the he's just a clown.
Yeah.
And he'll do and say anything it takes to maintain this, you know, drudge like craziness that gets him page clicks or whatever the fuck else.
Right. He sees political new media as being a business model and not something that is actually backed by any form of honesty or any sort of integrity whatsoever. And so what he does is he's just a professional instigator. He just says he says things to generate response. He's a troll is what he is. I mean, he's an internet troll and a well-paid one. And that's the big difference between just your regular, going back to where we started the show, the comment section. He's a guy who just says things to initiate response and doesn't care what the response is. And he's admitted that the things that he says are bullshit. I mean, he actually said that the videos that he does, that he finances with James O'Keefe, are bullshit. That they're complete, that they're tricks, they're hoaxes.
Yeah.
All right. So that should disqualify him from getting a place anywhere. Whether it's doing election night coverage for whatever it was, CNN, or getting a place
or
on the front.
A seat on the panel with Bill Maher. I mean, I don't know why Bill Maher still lets that guy on.
I don't know. Because
but you're right. He doesn't need Huffington Post exposure. I mean, I don't understand. He doesn't need that. I don't know why they would let him on in the first place. All it does is reduce Huffington Post's credibility. I mean, that's it. That there's no reason to let him latch on to your wagon.
Yeah, no, there's none. There's none whatsoever. Maybe he knows where some bodies are buried. I have no idea. Maybe that's why they're letting him in. But I mean,
he's one of the early contributors, early founders of
them. Yeah, I mean, he sort of was one of the early kind of brainchilds behind the whole idea.
Yeah.
And you know, in fact, I remember debating him in the comments at the Huffington Post during Katrina. He was actually defending President Bush's response to Katrina.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about baiting for a response.
And so it's no wonder why, you know, Lee Stranahan would pal up with this guy. Because they're cut from the same cloth. I mean, they're both professional instigators. They just say things to gain attention for themselves.
Yeah.
And so people ask me, well, why is Lee Stranahan doing this? Well, and why is he working with Andrew Breitbart? Well, because they're the same guy.
Yeah.
Just one has
the spectrum.
Right. The one has better teeth. You know, that's the only difference. I mean, that's what they do. They just go around poking people. And when you go, ow, what's your fucking problem? Well, that's what they want you to do.
Yeah.
So, obviously the best thing you can do with guys like this is to ignore them. But at the same time, they're so high profile. Speaking of Breitbart specifically, that you have to, to some degree, pick apart what they do, because otherwise we forget, and they end up on the Huffington Post or they end up on CNN, because people forget that he actually admitted to saying that the Acorn videos, the videos that resulted in the entire disbandment of Acorn, were complete hoaxes. So the reason why ACORN was disintegrated and ripped apart, defunded, and put out of business, basically, was all based on a lie.
Yeah.
And so he did the same thing with Shirley Sherrod. They're doing the same thing with NPR. And yet people continue to take it. So you have no choice but to try to pay attention to them and rip them to shreds, which is actually what they want. So it's like this big ongoing trap. You know? Uh-huh. they've really made a little nice little business model for themselves, haven't they?
Yeah. They should be very proud.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of business models, Sarah Palin continues her little plan for, I don't know what the hell she's trying to do. She's not running for president. She's not, I don't know what she's doing. I don't know if she is running for business. She might not. But I think to the extent that running for the Republican nomination is part of an ongoing media strategy rather than actually instituting better policy,
yeah.
That's what she's engaged in right now. And so she's been doing this world tour thing in an attempt to make herself seem more serious, when in fact it's kind of having the opposite effect. It's reinforcing her lack of seriousness.
Yeah, running around Israel wearing a Star of David, acting shocked when Jerusalem, you know, is, oops, you know, in Palestine. Oh, dear, you know, just these little, yeah, really ill-informed series of trips. And I don't see why she'd be doing it if she wasn't going to run.
Yeah,
I mean, a trip to Israel is an absolute reach around to the evangelical base. So I just don't think her ego, her narcissism can say no to at least a shot at Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, no, it's all part of her strategy. It's a part of, you know, what she does is she'll run for president. She'll make a good go of it. She'll make up a bunch of bullshit about why she ended up not getting the nomination. And, you know, she'll get enough people to feel sorry for her that she can sell a bunch of more books or do, you know, more speaking engagements. And just, it's all part of a plan for, you know, personal satisfaction,
gaining
her, yeah, increasing her wealth.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, there's nothing wrong with that. Just don't present yourself as being someone who's serious about running the country or having any real ideas. If you've got, you know, everything she's saying is all part of this model to make herself a more appealing reality show celebrity.
You know who I felt sorry for in the Israel trip was Todd. I mean, here's a picture of Sarah Palin standing next to Netanyahu, and over on the other side, there's Todd trying to look like he knows what the fuck's going on. He's in Israel standing next to the – I was just like, oh, Todd, how unfortunate for you. This,
yeah.
You know, this complete – redneck Alaska dimbulb douchebag, just you know, with his little goatee, smiling for the pictures, and he's in Israel. It's like, oh my god, how embarrassing!
Yeah. And then, so Sarah Palin's in Israel. She refers to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a zoning issue. She says President Obama was inappropriate to intervene in a zoning issue in Israel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let Israel decide their zoning issues themselves. It's like she's back in Wasilla deciding whether or not to put a Cabela's, you know, department store on on this street corner or that street corner. Yeah. Well, is that street corner zoned for a Cabela's or is that the other one? It's ridiculous.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Israel.
A zoning issue.
Things are heating up over there, man. There's been some fucking strikes. It's been some bombings and it's... I think that's going to be the next big crisis.
Mm. You mean it's a real crisis and not, you know, just a discussion as to whether or not there should be too many Starbucks in the town?
Are there Starbucks in Israel?
In Wasilla.
Oh, Wasilla. Oh, Sarah.
God. Yeah.
You're so serious.
And Chris Matthews has been continually cracking me up about her.
Yeah. He's just outraged. I mean, he's just morally indignant over the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
As well he should be, but I just love that he's showing it off.
Yeah, he really is. And I love when he says that she's going popping around. She's popping off. Popping around.
Okay. He really can't stand her.
No. But he's just been making me laugh lately. He just gets so outraged. Well, hey, that's it.
Yeah, what I'm didn't gonna we, bed now.
Yeah, we didn't get to a bunch of things. Oh, yeah, I should mention this. John Stossel is a major dick. Here, listen to what he said. This is John Stossel said. Why is there a Bureau of Indian Affairs? There is no Bureau of Puerto Rican Affairs or Black Affairs or Irish Affairs. And this is like almost like an Andy Rooney essay, but really dickish. You know, especially dick. Andy Rooney's a dick, but this would be especially dick. And no group in America that's been more helped by the government than the American Indians. Because we have the treaties, we stole their land, but 200 years later, no group does worse.
Oh my God. What an asshat. I was just up in sovereign Indian territory the other day, and let me tell you need a Bureau of Indian Affairs. Sorry. Yeah. Suck it, Stossel.
Why isn't there a Bureau of Puerto Rican Affairs or Black Affairs or Irish Affairs? Yeah, because, you know, the Irish...
What a jackass.
The Irish have had all of their land taken and their all of their customs and way of life completely destroyed, you know.
Maybe
raped,
because every
pillaged.
other way, I just... that's a whole other show. What a fuckhead.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Drive safely. You fudge with us. You fudge with the best. We'll see you next week for another show. Take care.
Bye-bye.
I protest. I am not a merry man.